Rich Kimble, Bruce Pratt, and it's time for Sports Lit 101. And excited to talk with the author of a book that we've chatted about a couple of times in recent weeks called The Best Team Over There, The Untold Story of Grover Cleveland Alexander and the Great War. Jim Leake joins us. Jim, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
It's a terrific book, as was your book, From Dugouts to the Trenches, Baseball During the Great War. I find it curious that not just in terms of baseball, but World War One in terms of writing just never seems to get the attention of World War Two. And to me, there are so many great stories. And well, you've proven that again with this new book.
Thank you. Yeah, I think there are a ton of great stories out of World War One. I think possibly it doesn't get the attention because it was our fathers and grandfathers who fought in World War II. And beyond that, there's not much firsthand connection anymore.
But you made an interesting point. My grandfather, who lived to be 105, fought in World War I. And he often talked about the difference between what happened to professional athletes then and later. I mean, we know Ted Williams missed a lot of at-bats, DiMaggio, all these guys. But what was lost for Christy Mathewson and Grover Cleveland Alexander was something a lot more. I mean, they essentially lost their careers to their service in the war, I think.
Well, I don't know that they lost them, but their careers and their lives were certainly affected by the war. Christy Mathewson, of course, died early. A lot of people connect that with being gassed during his service in France. That may not be strictly accurate, but Grover Cleveland Alexander certainly came back a changed man. He had problems going into the war, and he had a great deal more coming out of the war.
Jim, what's the biggest misperception people have about Grover Cleveland Alexander?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people view him as a great pitcher who was also sort of a hopeless alcoholic. That's somewhat unfair. He certainly was an alcoholic. He was an epileptic. He suffered from shell shock when he came back from the war. But to me, the triumph is how well he pitched for how long after the war. We sort of forget that. He was a tremendous, tremendous pitcher before the war, and he was a very good pitcher after the war when he could have totally fallen apart, I think.
He also could have opted out of the war. He was the sole surviving son. He would have had that exemption. And like Tony Lazzari, who suffered epilepsy, you know, people tried to sort of keep that undercover, which I'm sure made his life more difficult. Do you think that he was worried about his image if he didn't join, or do you think he just really thought it was something he should do?
I think he thought he should do it, though it was complicated. It's unclear exactly when his epilepsy started. If it started before the war, he wouldn't have wanted that known. He did request a deferment as sole support of his mother. It was not allowed by his draft board, so he went into the Army without complaint or reservation. It was a very complicated situation for any young American male of draft age during World War I, but especially for someone like Alexander, a professional athlete. Some people sought the exemption. Some people took exempted war work and pitched for shipyard teams and that sort of thing. Alexander went into the service. He was grabbed by his regiment because he was a ball player, but almost as soon as he got there, they shipped out for France. In France, he played ball a little bit, but they spent almost 7 weeks in constant combat. So once he got there, he was no longer a ball player. He was a soldier, and he had to be a soldier and a good one to survive the experience.
And of course, America didn't get into the war until late in 1917, but as Pete Alexander learned, and as so many other American soldiers learned and would find out firsthand, the worst fighting in that war happened in the last several weeks.
The worst part of it for American troops was the last several weeks. That's true. The British and the French had gone through horrible, horrible battles in the previous years. But for American troops, yeah, the Meuse-Argonne offensive was the big push and quite a shocking experience for most of them.
When he came back, when Grover Cleveland Alexander came back, he still faced an unsure future, I guess, because ball players came back. There was a question of, you know, who was going to hire him, even if they were under contract. Would they be traded? Would they be moved around? But he seemed to be especially eager to get back to playing baseball, not just getting home, if I read your book correctly. Do you think that had anything to do with his direct war experience, or do you think it had to do with his desire to get back on his feet financially and emotionally?
Well, I think that was probably the case for most of the returning ballplayers. They wanted to get back into the game for the game itself and for their livelihoods, of course, and to try to put the war behind them, which was not an easy task for a lot of them. And of course, they'd been away for X number of months or a year and a half. And when a very highly tuned athlete is away from his or her game for a while, they're not as good when they first come back. So a lot of the ball players had subpar years in 1919 and even into 1920. Now Alexander came back. He had a good year for most players, but a substandard year for him.
We're talking with Jim Leek here on Sportslit 101 on Downtown. His book is called The Best Team Over There. And Grover Cleveland Alexander went through a fate that many of the World War I veterans experienced. I mean, we think of the Bonus Army marching on Washington. Like a lot of guys, he struggled to get the benefits that he felt were due him. And there's a very poignant story in the book from late in his life when he talks about Cooperstown and says, they gave me a tablet up at Cooperstown, but I can't eat the tablet.
That's right. He appreciated the honor, but it didn't give him anything, essentially. He was pretty much down and out by that point. And by the time America entered World War II, Alexander was in and out of veterans hospitals and other hospitals. And he felt he got more from shell shock and being admitted to the vet's hospital than he did from the Hall of Fame plaque.
A lot of players in that age, in fact, virtually all of them, weren't able to really monetize their fame the way that once Ruth comes along and some other ball players after him are able to do that. How much of that do you think was controlled by the baseball establishment, and how much was just the agent hadn't really come to the fore yet in American sports?
Oh, I think that was just the era that baseball was in. There were a few players, superstars, who made a lot of money for the time. Pete made good money. He spent good money. After baseball, he simply didn't have much of anything left. Friends and teams tried to help support him. What he thought was a small pension was actually someone privately funding that donation. He was in and out of jobs. He was in and out of hospitals. He died broke, essentially. He had a hard way to go once he didn't play ball anymore.
There were certainly some big names that saw action in World War II. We think of Ted Williams, as we mentioned, Bob Feller, of course. But there were also a lot more players that got jobs in the military, working in offices and playing baseball largely. Did Major League Baseball and the military learn from World War I and the experience of people like Alexander and Christy Mathewson and try to do something differently in World War II?
No, I don't think they did much differently. In World War I, there were a lot of ball players who played service ball and never did get into combat. The same was true in World War II, I think. There were a number of ball players, who, of course, who did serve in combat in both wars, and some died. But there were more players, truthfully, who played service ball in the States or in rear areas. And I don't have any particular objection to that. I think that was legitimate. It was good for recruiting. It was good for troop morale. If you know, the boys could see the ball players playing the game in whatever uniform. So, no, I don't have any problem with that.
You mentioned in a number of places about the end of his life how the press regarded him as this incredibly tragic figure. You talk about his long on again, off again with wife Amy. Do you think that that there's, or did you intend to, with this book, and I think you did a great job, but did you intend to really want to put him in more human terms, take him away from the movie, take him away from the all the stories we heard growing up, and humanize him?
I absolutely did. And as I was working on the book, Alexander was always central to it, but he got larger and larger as I was working on it. It became more important to me to tell his story, to humanize him, because I think it's such an interesting and sad and illustrative story. And it says so much about veterans of that day and today. You know, today we call shell shock PTSD. The men and women who serve today have a lot of the same problems and challenges that Pete Alexander did. And it was important to share that, I think. I don't think there's a great deal of understanding among civilians and people who haven't served of the people who do serve then and now. So I really wanted to tell the whole story of Pete Alexander's Army service, where he trained, how he trained, where he went, what he saw, what he experienced, because it affected the whole rest of his life, and it affected the way we perceive him and others like him.
Did your service, Jim, make that even more important to you to tell that part of his story?
Absolutely. I served in the Navy at the very end of the Vietnam War. My service wasn't anywhere near as harrowing as Pete's was, but I absolutely felt some of the things he had to feel. And just like walking onto a military base for the first time as the in your first hour, and how intimidating that is. And I tried to put that type of thing into Pete's story.
Well, you certainly captured that so well, and helps us get a feel for what it was like. And even in writing about Christy Mathewson, too, has always been one of my favorite ball players. The numbers he put up were so incredible, but he, too, comes across as an even more heroic figure for his service.
Right. Christy, he's one of my favorites, too. I may yet write about him and his service in World War One. You know, he didn't have to go. A lot of them didn't have to go. Branch Rickey didn't have to go. People like that. But they thought it was important that they do it, and they signed up and they went. The war ended pretty quickly after they got there, but it doesn't make their going any less admirable.
No, and it proves, as any veteran of wars can tell you, that the war doesn't end when they sign the peace treaty, that you carry that with you forever. And Pete Alexander certainly is proof of that.
That's absolutely true. When you come back changed. Maybe you've changed a little bit. Maybe you've changed totally. But to some degree, you come back changed.
I think of how we have this image that has come down of Alexander, and think of how someone like Mickey Mantle, who had, you know, obviously terrible problems with alcohol and led a less than, shall we say, virtuous private life, all that was hidden in his day and age until much later on. But it seems to me that there was something about the sports writers and the sports world of the 20s that really didn't mind really attacking players in a different kind of way. Not that it doesn't happen today. Do you think any of that weighed on Alexander?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think he went through life in sort of a strange, detached way. It's possible that his head injury and his other problems, PTSD, may have affected the way he interacted with people and the way he made decisions, the way he saw things. It's very hard to know after all this time. But Pete, he didn't seem to hold grudges. I've never come across any account of him being mean or bitter. Everyone talks about what a gentleman and what a gentleman he was. So he's a very interesting person to me.
He sure is. Well, it's a wonderful read. You bring him to life for us. So the book is called The Best Team Over There. Jim Leake, we enjoyed the book a great deal and enjoyed even more the chance to talk with you about it this afternoon. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate your interest in the story.
Jim Leake with us here on Downtown Sports Lit 101. Bruce, and we've got another guest on the segment next week from right here in Maine.
Yes, we have the director of the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance, who is also a fabulous poet, Gibson Faye LeBlanc. He will talk about Deek Dangle Dive, his poetry collection, which deals with the loss of his beloved brother to cancer and hockey and being a parent and a husband. And it's a really, really excellent collection of poems.
Great. That's coming up next Wednesday on Sports Lit 101.